It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Nick Lloyd, the author Nick Lloyd of the new book, The Western Front. Nick is a reader in military and imperial history at King's College. And no matter where you read military history, Verdun and Somme will come up. Verdun is the Germans on the offensive. Somme is the British and the French on offensive. What I learned from Nick's presentation is they're twinned. First, Verdun. It launches in early 1916. It's a fortress, a series of fortresses, way out to the right, very far from Paris. Why, Nick? Why did they launch? Why did Falkenhayn launch on Verdun? What did he imagine he would accomplish? And in accomplishing it, how would it end the war? His vision.
Yeah, I mean, you get 1916, there's that terrible, terrible year where you get these two battles, as you mentioned. And this year is almost the image of the Western Front that we have. When we think of the Western Front, it's usually 1916 or 1917. Verdun and the Somme are those two horrific battles that, you know, have come to epitomize that horror. Verdun is interesting because it's a reject, you know, Falkenhayn has spent 1915 essentially winning the war in the East and conquering Serbia, destroying parts of the Russian army. And then he returns to the West in 1916 and decides to attack the French. And the whole idea, and he's not that explicit about it at the time. Sometimes he throws a bit of sand in people's eyes, but the whole idea is we can't really break through. That's not really what I need to do. What I need to do is kill Frenchmen, and I need to ratchet the slaughter up so high that they will give up. So it's a very modern, it's a very ruthless perception. It's quite different. You know, it's quite different to other battles where, certainly in the early stages of the war, Allied commanders want to break through. They want to gain ground. Killing Germans is kind of secondary. For Falkenhayn, that's the primary goal. And that's why Verdun becomes this sort of concentrated experiment in killing.
It's a meat locker. My goodness. The battles are impossible to separate. It's one constant massacre on both sides. And the French keep feeding forces in. The Germans keep feeding forces in, and shells. They're always running low on shells. The one person who seemed to have an ability to innovate, wasn't it Petain who rotated divisions into the front line, and the Germans just used them until they were exhausted?
Yes, that's correct. You get Petain comes in and manages the defensive battle in Verdun, and he does this rotation, so divisions will not be in line for that long. And again, they might take heavy losses, but he'll bring them out. He'll make sure they get care, they get appropriate, what we might call R&R. German divisions would stay in the line until basically there's not a lot left, and then the remnants would be brought out. But on both sides, you get this terrible exchange of losses. And Verdun's actually quite a small battlefield, so the concentration of firepower and artillery in that small area is really, really frightening. And it produces this great moonscape effect. And that's what certainly horrified Petain when he saw it. And he saw what it did to men. And he saw the shattered remnants of the comeback. And I think that really struck him quite deeply. So, you know, Verdun is one of those critical battles, which ultimately is not decisive. The French aren't destroyed. The casualty rates are actually quite similar. So Falkenhayn is never able to ratchet it up so much that he's not losing a lot of manpower. And it's almost like, as I went through the book, I think until the end of 1915, the Germans are in a pretty good position. They're good in the East. They've really damaged the Russian army. They've conquered Serbia. And they've held on in the West. And they're almost in a position where you could think they are well ahead in the war. But the decision to mount the attack on Verdun in February 1916 is the moment where things start to go wrong for Germany. And I would argue she never really recovers.
It is very clear from your presentation to me, the reader, that some was meant to relieve the pressure on Verdun. However, all of a sudden you had other interests, other ambitions, including those who said that this would be the opportunity, with the Germans distracted or drained by Verdun, to break through. It's Haig again, always the offensive spirit. And I want to jump into a dispute that I can imagine has carried on for 100 years. Rawlinson was Haig's choice to lead the Battle of the Somme, which is launching in the summer of 16. Rawlinson believes in bite and hold. What did that mean? And what did that mean to Haig?
I think this is a really important part of the book, because you have this relief offensive and the idea that the British are finally in 1916. We've mentioned how small the British were in 1914 when the war starts. By 1916, they're much bigger, but they're quite green, and they aren't really tested in that sense. They've undergone an enormous expansion, and they want to attack on the Somme. And quite quickly, you have this difference of opinion between Haig, commander-in-chief, and Rawlinson, his army commander, about how you should attack on the Western Front. And I think it's indicative of the currents of thought that are going on, the sort of bubbled away through 1915 about how you fight on the Western Front. Now, Haig always has a reputation, certainly in Britain, as this sort of stale, attritional commander. But Haig is always quite, you know, optimistic in what he wants to achieve. And what he wants to do on the Somme is break through and maneuver and get his men and his cavalry out in the open where they can defeat the German army. So quite traditional in that sense. Rawlinson says, and he's more like the kind of tradition that you get in the French army, which is actually the point is not to do that. So Rawlinson says, well, gaining a few miles of French farmland isn't that important. What is important is killing Germans. So you can see the echo of Falkenhayn and Verdun. And he says, what we can do is we could concentrate our artillery on the first and second lines and smash them, take them, stop, bring the guns up. We made the bite, we'll hold on, and then we'll do it again. We won't break through. We'll just gradually break down the German defenses. And again, this goes on, and Haig does not like this. And Haig never really moves from this idea of breakthrough. So he doesn't really like what Rawlinson is offering. But I would argue that the British are only really capable of what Rawlinson is suggesting in 1916. They can take the first line of trenches a little bit more, maybe, but that's all they can really do, because they don't have the artillery. They don't have the know-how. They don't have the weapon systems to go further. So the debate between Haig and Rawlinson is really interesting, and it illustrates the different approaches that different commanders had to the kind of dilemmas that the Western Front presents.
The British cabinet was reluctant about some, or mixed about some. The idea was we were working with the French. So I want to go to the French quickly here, because there we've mentioned Nivelle before, who was only briefly commander-in-chief. He replaces Joffre. However, the question here is, were the French demanding the British work with them, or were these separate armies with separate audiences looking for advantage back home? The puzzle is Nivelle's offensive. You know it very well, April 17. The Somme and Verdun have lasted long enough so that they're no longer the focus. The hills are covered with bones. But Nivelle's idea is to launch an offensive to break through, a tactical advantage he believes that he can succeed with in a massive number of guns, with air power. In other words, they're beginning to fight a three-dimensional war. He wants the British to help him by launching an attack on Vimy Ridge. However, there's a war council, April of 17, with Nivelle, Castelnau, Pétain, Desprez, Michelet of the 6th, Mangin, who will lead the 6th Army, and Nivelle. What is the debate that right before the Nivelle offensive, what is the hesitation or the concern for the French political life?
What we see is that these two great battles, the Somme and Verdun, that we talked about, smolder on through 1916, but ultimately they are a terrible experience for the Germans, for the British, for the French. But decisive victory seems quite far away. And, you know, there's this growing sense of impatience, as you can imagine. And Nivelle is promoted. Joffre, as I mentioned before, is kicked upstairs. They need someone fresh, someone with new ideas. And Nivelle seems to have what he calls the formula. And so they don't really know what the original plan for 1917 is, to continue the Somme into 1917. That's what Haig wants to do. But when Joffre is kicked upstairs, all the plans get essentially scrubbed and they start again. Now, Nivelle's perspective is the French cannot continue the war for much longer. They are running out of manpower. They're running out of patience. There's only so much they're going to do. And so he believes that with the right artillery support, with the right gunfire, with the right plan, he can essentially do what Joffre had wanted to do in 1915, which is break through on that crucial sector along the Chemin des Dames. Not Champagne, which is what Joffre wanted. Nivelle chooses the Chemin des Dames. And they can do this, and they must do this now, or else they will fail. And so this sets the scene for what will become, you know, one of the darkest periods of the war for the Allies. And the British aren't particularly, they are not really that happy with this, but Lloyd George, who distrusts Haig, quite likes Nivelle. And from his perspective is, well, if the French are going to do the fighting, the French are going to lead this attack, well, we can support them. And so he orders Haig to support them. So this causes quite a bit of ill feeling between the British and French, but ultimately it goes ahead. And I think this illustrates one of the problems of the Allies' war, certainly in the first half of the war, is the British and French largely fight separate wars. Now, they are joined side by side on the Western Front, but there isn't a unified commander, there isn't unified staff, there's not unified training or weapons procurement or supplies. The French do their thing, the British do our thing. And if we can coordinate time, you know, we'll attack at the same time or whatever we can do, but it's quite limited. And I think that's one of the big problems that the Allies have, which is only really solved with the ascension of Ferdinand Foch. We talked about it a bit earlier in 1918. It's one of the key lessons that the Allies learn during the war. They have to work together much more closely than either, you know, the British or French really would like. Certainly the British are the problem here because they don't particularly want to be subordinated to the French. But the French, they would love to subordinate the British. But that is difficult for the British for many, many reasons.
What it looks like is that Haig launches his attack in April. He said, yes, I'll support you. He launches his attack, and they take the Vimy Ridge. They do a wonderful job. And you have a grisly observation as they take Vimy Ridge that the bones of the Moroccans who were there in 15 are still on the ground. It's an incredible scene of gore, but they take it. And Haig is successful. And yet, Nivelle's offensive is quite independent of whether that would have been successful or not. In addition, Nivelle's defensive is, as you emphasized, tactical. Nivelle seems quite out of his depth. Is that an opinion today, Nick?
I think so. I mean, I think we would love a new biography of Nivelle. I think, you know, there's limited work on him, but a new biography would be really interesting to read. He's a very interesting character. But I think you're right. I think ultimately he's just not able to make that leap from essentially a battlefield commander to a national commander in chief that can see the strategy, can see the big picture, as it were. And he miscalculates badly in 1917 in terms of what the French can do. Tries to do the big breakthrough again, which is really, really difficult to do in that 16-17 period because the defenses are too thick and you don't have the kind of technology, the mobility, the vehicles that will allow you to break through. So he tries to do too much, and ultimately the morale issue, you know, the French have lost to, you know.
Well, mutiny, revolution. So, yes, execution.
So the Allies come close. Yeah, absolutely. The Allies come very close to losing the war in 1917. Yeah. I think that's why the American involvement is so crucial.
Yes, let's go to the Americans. Pershing's about to arrive, and that changes the atmosphere both in Germany and in France. Nick Lloyd is the author. The Western Front is the new story of the first volume of the history of the Great War, 1914-1918, a war that will determine the 20th century and maybe the 21st. Too early to tell. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.